We're glad you're here, and we're sorry we're rushed. Thank you.
I'm glad to be here as well, and I really appreciate the statements that were made before me. I think I've learned some things. I think I disagree with some things, but mm-hmm. I guess at the point that we get into the discussion, some of that will be brought out. It's my understanding that the very title of my presentation has caused some stirrings of disagreement. Why would I choose such a title, since feminism, anti-racism, and the peace movement is the title of this overall workshop and something which each of us, black and white, is supposed to be addressing? Perhaps I would do my presentation a great service by first laying out some of the points of departure from which I will proceed. In one of the presentations, several of the presentations, you know, we kept hearing the significance of the interconnection of our struggles, and I think that that's, you know, what I'd like to have appreciated, that there is an interconnection. At the same time, when asked what comes first, race, sex, peace, and that they all are kind of on the same plane, I think we should recognize that very often these things have been defined by some other people. For example, in the 50s, when Rosa Parks sat on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama, she was not dragged off of that bus because she was a woman. She was dragged off of that bus because she was a black person. So that while, you know, we would like to say that my gender and my race are on an equal plane, there are some realities which we are confronted with that I'm sure we must deal with. I'd like to start with a poem by Audre Lorde. Who said it was simple? There are so many roots to the tree of anger that sometimes the branches shatter before they fall. Sitting in Nedix, the women rally before they march, discussing the problematic girls they hire to make them free. An almost white counterman passes a waiting brother to serve them first, and the ladies neither notice or reject the slighter pleasures of their slavery. But I, who am bound by my mirror as well as my bed, see causes in color as well as in sex, and sit here wondering which me will survive all these liberations. First, the history of African American people in the United States is a history of resistance. From Nat Turner to Rosa Parks, from Sojourner Truth to Malcolm X, black people have resisted oppression, degradation, and injustice at every level of their existence in the United States. It is my contention that the black female has played a significant role in this resistance. And a view of the past three decades alone, where Rosa Parks ignited the Montgomery bus boycott on December 1, 1955, to Asada Secor, also known as Joanna Chesimard, who continues to carry the revolutionary tradition forward in a leadership capacity, would show us this. Black women have historically participated in every facet of the anti-racism, feminism, and peace movement from writers such as Gloria Joseph, and I had a whole list, but because we're in time, I'll go off, to labor organizers, from community activists. Black women have participated in every avenue of struggle for justice, jobs, peace, and freedom. Two, when looking at the history of America, the survival, and I underline the word survival, of the African race within the boundaries of these United States is in of itself a form of resistance. I quote from Gerda Lerner, editor of Black Women in Right America, a documentary history, quote, over and over again, in their 350 years of history, black people in white America have had to struggle for sheer survival, not only physical and economic survival, but spiritual survival was at stake as generation after generation sought to come to terms with an impeccably hostile and exploitative environment. 3, the history of resistance in the United States of all other groups during the last 3 decades has been a history that has been inspired by the anti-racism and peace movement of the African American nation in this country. While some people will acknowledge this, most people tend to believe that the history of resistance to sexism, to racism, and war began with the peace movement of the 60s when it became predominantly white in color. 4, my definitions of sexism and its counterpart, feminism, racism and its counterpart, nationalism, and if you will, self-determination for African American people, for Chinese American people, for Chicano American people, etc., and peace versus its counterpart, war, all lie within an understanding, analysis of the very system which has developed racism, sexism, and war to some of its most sophisticated forms, capitalism, paternalism. We can't talk about ending the evils of racism, sexism, and war without talking about the termination of their root causes in the world today. Systems of injustice, and an era which constantly plagues all 3 of these movements, that is the anti-racism movement, the peace movement, and the feminist movement, is the notion that sexism, racism, and war can be ended in the United States without the destruction of capitalism first. Yes, we can struggle against racism. We must struggle against racism. But the bottom line is that racism is as American as apple pie. And the recent Democratic primaries have shown us that the apples are alive and well. We can't end racism without ending capitalism. Racism is systemic. Yes, we can struggle against sexism. We must struggle against sexism. But history has proven that those in power never give up that power until they are overthrown. They might make a few concessions, and they might even encourage women to put on a suit and tie or a hard hat in the conditions when the conditions are ripe, such as during World War II. But concessions are always granted so that they can be taken back. We can't end sexism in the United States without a total rearrangement of the United States. And peace. What is that when black men, women, and children can be killed at any point, in any place, in these United States by either civilians or those in uniform without the murderer ever having to spend a night in jail or even to think of life in jail? From the disproportionate number of black soldiers on the front lines in Vietnam to the recent bombings in Nicaragua, we understand that peace is inextricably interwoven with racial justice at home and abroad. It is no wonder that significant numbers of black people have not gotten involved in the anti-nuke movement when survival today becomes an issue, when infant mortality, for example, in the black community is twice the infant mortality rate for the rest of the country as a whole. When 70% of our youth can't find a job, and a large percentage of those will never see a job. When 80% of the urban prisons are black and Latin, as compared to a less than 20% black population in these United States. And of course, I could go on with these statistics, but these statistics don't even begin to touch the day-to-day crisis, struggle for survival, that makes peace important on the one hand when we're talking about an overall concept or a holistic concept of peace, but not a priority to many people on the other. Because those of us with consciousness recognize the fact that war in recent years has hurt the black and brown population of this world disproportionately to the white population. To say nothing of the fact that the wars that are being fought to keep the Rockefeller class in comfort and to prevent the self-determination of those people being invaded. We have, as a whole, participated in support movements for the liberation struggles of the world and anti-draft movements right here at home. 4, militarism, A system which places funds in the budget for war while snatching away funds for service areas within the black and white communities in these United States is affecting black and brown communities because we already occupy the bottom of the service ladder in this country at an even greater proportion than that of the white community. So we must be concerned with militarism and we must take anti-militarism stands. My intention here is not to pit the two communities against each other. My suggestion, however, is that as we start to examine the realities of militarism and attempt to determine how much time we have before warmongers cast us into destruction, we've got to determine, one, who and what is the main enemy of the world today, and two, what are the main forces countering the movement toward war, and three, how we must operate independently and collectively to change the course of world events. By way of an introduction to some other statements I'd like to make concerning where we are in these movements, I'd like to read an excerpt from a book by Gloria Joseph and Jill Lewis, Common Differences, Conflicts in Black and White Feminist Perspectives. This statement kind of summarizes the 60s and gives us some background for where we are today. A courageous feature of the 60s movement during its later stages was the emphasis on uniting all the downtrodden, regardless of race. Thus, Native Americans, poor whites, Asian Americans, Hispanics, all who were suffering from some form of discrimination were engaged in this struggle. It was black leadership's articulation and analysis of third world struggles that was responsible for the multiracial alliances within a movement in which the overwhelming majority of protesters were black. In 1979, a look at the record of black and white cooperation and at progress made by blacks showed that blacks and whites were not closer socially or politically, nor had the overall economic picture for black people improved. Actually, the social and economic gap between blacks and whites has widened since the 60s, when the dream began its march into the manifestation stages. It was a little over 13 years ago when thousands of black people responded to the murder of Martin Luther King with riots and rebellions. Today, the rights demanded by the protesters are still out of reach. Living conditions, jobs, and education levels for the vast majority of black people have not improved. In some cases, they have been worsened. Joblessness amongst black youth is near 60%. Recent statistics say 70%. The gap between white and black incomes has widened. Black medical doctors comprise only 2.2% of their profession, black lawyers 3.4%, and black engineers 1.0%. Nationwide, blacks comprise close to 50% of the prison population, even though blacks comprise less than 20% of the total United States population. The death rate for minority preschool children is approximately 50% higher than for white children. Today, the black liberation movement has lost its news-making attraction, and the women's movement has emerged as the current popular social movement in the United States. As yet, we do not sing women and men together, we shall overcome. On the contrary, many people feel that the women's movement implies a severe separation of men and women. And she goes on to talk about the fact that, you know, this book is committed to trying to point to some of the differences as well as the similarities in the perspective toward the feminist movement here. Now, in the 80s, we look at a resurging movement for peace, for jobs, and freedom when we look at the encampment in Seneca, I think, which inspired all of us that, you know, saw the slides. And also, for those of us who are black, when we look at the campaign of Reverend Jesse Jackson for the presidency of the United States. Since we had a presentation on Seneca, I'd like to suggest that the campaign of Jackson is the largest campaign in this country for jobs, for peace, for the rights of all women and not just white women, and for justice against racism. Jackson is the only candidate, as yet, who has not only given lip service to the ERA, but has developed a position paper expressing the need of the equality of women in this nation. He is the only real peace candidate that advocates total withdrawal of our troops from Latin America and the rights of struggling people in Africa, Latin America, Asia, for self-determination. And he is the only candidate that suggests unity between all oppressed peoples here in the United States. Of course, I could go on, but this is not a stand-up for Jesse Jackson speech, but a suggestion that there is a movement taking place around this man, which we can classify as a movement for peace, a movement for women's rights, and a movement for racial justice. Of course, it is very unfortunate that racism has not allowed people to be supported of this movement in a way that would be a real statement to the power brokers of this country. If we had only dared join hands this one time, then perhaps our attempts at unity in the future would be less difficult. At this point, I'd like to end with a quote from a piece by Sundiata Okoli entitled Some Solutions or Some Things to Do, and I think it basically summarizes how we should move. We already know what strategy the enemy will use: divide and conquer. He will try to divide us from ourselves, from other domestic forces, and from international forces. To win, we must do just the opposite of what the enemy desires. Fighting to win, in the first sense, means we must divide the enemy while uniting our own forces. That means we unite blacks on independence, we unite the Native American struggle to regain their land and sovereignty, we unite with the Chicano Mexicans' struggle for national liberation and regaining of their land. We unite with the Puerto Rican struggle for independence, for socialism, for Puerto Rico. We unite with the Asian American struggle for domestic and human rights and against oppression of minority and nationalities. We unite with the oppressed white classes on progressive goals and with revolutionary whites on socialist revolution in the United States. And we unite with progressive international countries, movements, and organizations on common goals. That in itself will divide the enemy. Yet we must divide him further while uniting our forces further at every stage. Victory is dependent on each of us doing just that. Andre and I both find a heroine in Assata Sakur, and I had planned to end with a quote from her, but instead I will end with a quote from the heroic people struggle of Grenada: forward ever, backwards never. Thank you.
Here. It's now 12:30, and I think we should take 20 minutes at least for a discussion. Would anybody want to stay past that? I'll stay past that, certainly. I kind of need a second to get my breath after Zala. I really think that what we need to talk about and what we can use this forum to discuss is how, what it is the vision that we see ultimately, and what is the steps that we think we can get there, because for my own part, I constantly find myself talking about peace and nonviolence and thinking that, yes, peace is what I'm wanting, but really at this point, uproar is what I'm wanting. You know, and how do all of us who really want to make things better work out what we really feel inside, which is we have to make things very different and very much louder and very much more, much less peaceful in some ways? I don't know how to reconcile it. We have some women here from Greenham Common who perhaps could give us a little update on exactly what's happening there. It certainly isn't peaceful in any understanding of the word that we normally accept. They're being evicted every day. Maybe, Quinn, if you have a word or two you'd want to give. Sure, we have time to do that. This is a real example of how peace is far from passive. Wait, turn to the microphone, Quinn. Just to go on tape.
Yeah.
Just so
that
it can go on the table.
It's for the tape.
Sorry.
Tape. 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 Comments. Well, I'm Gwyn, and I live in London, but I've been here for a while, involved in a lawsuit that Green and Women are bringing against Reagan. That's not to say that women in Britain think that we need to turn our attentions to lawsuits and stop doing direct action. The camp is continuing, and I really want to say to everyone in the room, please tell everyone you know that this is the situation, because we are very few people here, and constantly plagued by telephone calls from people who are saying, I'm really freaking out, they've evicted the camp. And my reaction to that is, why do you believe what you read in the New York Times? Since when has the New York Times been giving out the truth on these kinds of issues? As far as I know it, there are women at 8 gates at the camp, as there have been for quite a long time now. And although police harassment is bad, there are women who are determined to be there. This is not the first eviction there's been at Greenham. There have been many evictions in the past, and women have always found ways of staying there. It's the first eviction that has been widely reported in the United States, both on television and in the newspapers, and people have the impression that the thing is over, final, and finished. Of course, that's what they want you to think. So please tell people that's not the case. Even if it were the case, I think it should only redouble our efforts, both here and there, to keep going on this particular issue. Thanks for the opportunity to make that announcement.
So I'll accept any questions from the floor. I'd like to put out, first of all, that this forum is being taped for BAI. We can't ask everybody to sign a release, but women in the room who would want to withhold their names should just be aware that this is what's happening, and be careful if you're in trouble. You know, if you're worried about getting on tape, be aware that you're getting on tape. So, go.
Two questions for Nesta and one for anybody who wants to answer. Nesta, it's the use of pacifism to a woman who's attacked on the street one-on-one.
I'll repeat the questions afterwards also.
For a woman who's attacked one-on-one on the street. Second question is the use of pacifism now in Nicaragua. Second question for the panel, I think that all the things about the connections are, we hope someday, obviously true. What I'd like to see is some reflection on economic structures. Because I think that all the panelists made the important point that material impoverishment is the major cause of the motivation for militarism. What I haven't seen in a feminist movement yet, which is just a hope that I'll see in the future, is now that we know again that capitalism is the enemy, who's the friend?
Okay, I'm just going to repeat this for the benefit of the tape, anyone that didn't hear, that we are being asked that what's the use of pacifism in a one-on-one attack on a woman, what's the use of pacifism in the current struggle in Nicaragua, and what is the feminist movement going to do with its analysis of connections unless it really addresses material and economic connections as well as the...
How are we going to do it?
Right.
Okay, you want me to go first? Well, first of all, pacifism is a way of thinking about it. It's a philosophy. I mean, you don't throw a philosophy at someone who's attacking you. So, I mean, if what you mean is what's the use of nonviolent direct action against someone who's attacking you? I mean, attacking you on the street. I mean, I think feminist thinking about nonviolence and violence and pacifism is evolving. I mean, I myself make a distinction, for example, between a movement of collected people engaging in intentional action and trying to figure out how to go about doing this, and the immediate response of a woman on the street to being attacked. I think if I was attacked, would prefer to talk my way out of it. I think that would just be, if it were possible, you know, that would be a better way to do it. If I didn't think that was going to work, and these are judgments that get made like this, and I could figure out some way to inflict enough injury on my opponent to get away, I would do it. But it's an abstract question in a way, and I feel like it's not a fair question, because when I talk about pacifism, I'm talking about how people together decide to engage in some sort of collective action against state power and against the coercion and violence of the state. And I'm talking, and I think that presents us with a different situation. I feel differently about Joanne Little in her jail cell with her jailer. I've talked about this with many women who think of themselves as pacifists, and I think, you know, and as feminists, and I think that this is a really shared kind of perspective. I mean, that. And was your question about Nicaragua or El Salvador?
Nicaragua. The second question is, because I thought that's what you'd say about the first one, but if you're going to talk about it as a strategy for collective action, then and it's really it's a question for information, not as criticism. But what you see as the use, I mean the use in a country like Nicaragua of a pacifist philosophy. I don't think philosophy is abstract. I think it ought to be the most concrete thing in our lives.
Well, I think also, I think first of all that I don't understand enough, and I don't mean because I haven't read enough or talked to enough people from Nicaragua, I mean because I'm not Nicaraguan, because I'm not in that situation, to make some sort of judgment about how people should proceed with that struggle. I mean, I'm very aware that my own pacifist thinking and commitment comes out of being an American, of being a white American, of thinking about what that means in the world today, and that's really, you know, about as far as I go with it. And, you know, someone can say that this is inconsistent or you're topping out, but I don't really care, because I think that, at the moment, I don't think I can come up with something like that's like total consistency. I mean, I think I can just try and proceed as honestly as I can, and that my position on Nicaragua and El Salvador and all of that, you know, is against intervention, is for self-determination. And I wouldn't say what I would do if I were in that situation. I do know that I've talked with many Nicaraguans and El Salvadorans who talk about the cost of violence, the difficulty of violence, the reluctance with which the gun was taken up, the need to engage, the escalation of the violence because of the U.S. Role in the area, and how much bloodier, you know, and prolonged and agonizing and horrible, you know, that the struggle has been, you know. And so I think that's really more where I've concentrated my sort of commitment to nonviolence, you know, is in trying to do something about those things and thinking about those things. So that's really as much of an answer as I can give.
I think she was opening it up to the whole panel to discuss the other part of her question.
Which was,
how, in the future, is feminist movement going to take steps to deal with the materialist analysis of oppression? Yes?
I'd like to say something about that.
Sure.
Before I do say address that in particular, I'd like to just pick up on what was being said about pacifism. I think that we all recognize, you know, if we've been involved in, you know, struggles for social justice, that pacifism is obviously one means of resistance. Mm-hmm. You know, it is not a panacea. But at the same time, when we look at the question of Nicaragua, obviously Nicaragua is not in position to respond with militarism at the level that the United States is able to deal with it. So the Nicaragua took its case to the World Court. But I think a question that we have to deal with is, how do you make an international outlaw this government, which violates international law, the charters of regional bodies, its own laws, and refuses to come before the World Court? How do you make that kind of government responsive? And, you know, I think it just goes back to pacifism being one means, but obviously not the totality of the quality of responses that are needed to make real change in this country and in this world. The other thing, in terms of economic theory in relationship to the future types of social orders that will render a quality existence and one that also is peaceful or has the quality of peace. I think I would have to go back to something that Martin Luther King Jr. said, and he said that human's future, the future of humankind, will not hinge entirely on capitalism or communism, but will be a synthesis of the two. And I really believe that that is the direction that probably the world will go in. I think at some point women will start to develop economic theories, you know, that may broaden what is currently being posed as two, you know, divergent views. But that's the only comment that I wanted to make on it. Okay.
No more responsibilities. Take another question.
In talking about the interconnectedness of different issues, I'd just like some comments on working with sexist men on other issues. I've had a lot of experience in the anti-interventionist and peace movements, where I've gotten so frustrated with sexist procedures and attitudes that I've just said, forget it. And how do we, as feminists, deal with this problem in other issues?
Okay, so the question is, how do we deal with sexist men in organizing? You don't just give up.
I'll say something. Well, just real, you know, off the top, something that I think of having gone through the struggle at Mecca Evers, which is 75% female, is that first of all, it's difficult to respond to it qualitatively or effectively as an individual. Mm. That in really having some measurable kind of impact, you must respond as part of collective group. And I think history informs us that that is the way that we have to respond to sexism as well. Even in cases of nations that have had social revolutions, for example, Cuba, even after they opened the doors for women to be involved in social or socialist production, so to speak, they found that women were not really participating at the levels that they were reflected in the population. Mm-hmm. And they had to deal with sexism in the household and make other kind of adjustments in the society to involve women. But in that instance, it wasn't the men who said, okay, we got to make these changes. It was the Federation of Cuban Women who analyzed what was happening and the data and said that these changes must be made. And they took a lot of steps and did a lot of political education to create public opinion so they could move forward, you know, which they did and put things into law as well.
I think that the collective response is something that's very needed, but I also think that, you know, we have to have some individual responses, and that has to do with what you will and what you will not do and what you will and will not accept. Andrea and I are very, very close, and we spend a lot of time dealing with the problem, verbally dealing with the problem of sexism, you know, in an institution where, you know, we've had a very clear fight against racism, okay, and Jim Crowism, but that how when it came to the question of the rights of women, you know, we started to get some reaction from both males and females who had been indoctrinated with the view of sexism. But I think on an individual level, you know, we have to reach a point where there are certain things we will not tolerate. Now, that's not to say that the power structure is still not in a position to be all powerful over you, and you say you won't tolerate it, okay, you're fired, right? but then that's also, again, the case as in racism, that, you know, you still fight, you know, even at the point that there's some very, very significant risks involved. And it becomes very crucial, I think, that because of the sexism and the frustration that may come out of it, that we don't then flip to the side of making these people our enemy, because they are not necessarily, and in most cases are not our enemy. And they too, the sexist male, have to go through a process of re-education, all right? Just as it would be easy for me as a black person to then just say, hey, all white folks are my enemy. There was a process of education that made me recognize that that's not true, that my enemy is very specific. And I think that, you know, the same applies to, you know, my understanding of how sexism operates, that, you know, I won't see all men as my enemy, but that on an individual day-to-day basis, you know, something short of the collective response which we must make is a response that I, Zala Chandler, must make, that there are certain things that I will tolerate and certain things that I won't tolerate, and that I will fight physically, mentally, in all kind of other ways against.
Andrew.
This is the mantra.
Some internal bell rang, I think.
I'd like to talk about racism, since this is obviously a forum on making a connection, but I think highlighting racism. I tried to make this into a
question, but I can't know. So this is sort of a comment, asking for comments, which is that I'm involved now with the opening of Seneca for the second year. And the reason I'm involved with it is because I see very strongly that it's a fulcrum where women, all different kinds of women, can come together and can be a cutting, fighting edge for addressing the kinds of issues that you're addressing. And for being, you know, for really doing the kinds of things that Greenham is doing, which is constantly raising the issue and really challenging people in the area and around the country. But, and my main reason also for getting involved was because what I saw last year is there was a lot of lip service given towards making connections and towards really having women of all different backgrounds come to speak for, and having women be part of the organizing, but that didn't happen last year. And part of the reason I think it didn't happen was because there was so much work to be done. And I think this is sort of the kinds of things we have to address here, is that you have to prioritize. I mean, it's like dealing with racism or dealing with childcare or dealing with issues for the physically challenged take extra work, right, if you're a mostly white organizing group at the beginning. And because there was so much to do last year, that never happened, right? The extra, I mean, this is my understanding, and people could say that that's incorrect, but I think it was just because there wasn't time, you know, and it was just an energy. But now, here we have a second year, and it's April, and I see the same things happening all over again. And that it just really scares me and disappoints me when here we have this chance to really create and build something, and I hear everyone's always talking about it, and that the same old shit is happening again. Part of that is because it's not as 4%, you know, people down in New York City are probably supporting Seneca as much as they were last year, which is understandable, it's a much more upstate local thing. I just have to sort of scream and cry to you because, you know, you're the woman who I guess I understand to some extent. The idea is to get people involved in the beginning.
This isn't a response again or a question either. It's a sharing of concern, partly from what I heard you say in terms of redefining passive and looking at things differently. That seems to be the charge that we have as women. How do you define passivism, and how does that get determined any more than feminism as just being passive and not moving? If you look at some of the origins of the concepts of where passivism or that concept came from, you get back to African cultures and Eastern cultures, which embrace yins and yangs and unity and conflicts and opposites as part of the normal makeup of everything. No more than being feminine means you can't think or you can't fight. Does passive mean you sit down and just lay down? Sometimes it may mean having to use a creative energy or a resource that is not as apparent or as obvious. And I think that's a charge that we may have. The same way as if a woman is attacked, if she doesn't have the same strength, she may have to learn or she may have to use a martial arts and let the person go by her by using her body differently, as if she cannot just fight. And I think we are called on to deal with and look at things from a creative perspective as women. I think that until we seriously address the issues that are being brought up here, it's not going to happen. I mean, we cannot look at it in a linear progression and say, we're going to do this and prioritize this. We have to look and we have to think in circles. We have to think and even the philosophy. The philosophy can't be a linear philosophy that we can take from the philosophy from the past, either handed down by a patriarchal system. We have to recreate it. And I think that's the choice. I would like to know from the people on the panelists, how are we going to deal with, what do you see as a possibility for even some kind of dialogue amongst ourselves to deal with, how are we going to incorporate and interconnect the problems of racism and feminism? Because I'm hearing the problems, and I know we're all feeling that, but we still haven't gotten down to the nitty-gritty of what kind of councils are we going to set up, or what are we going to do?
Answers, yeah.
My answer is kind of going back to what Andrea was talking about. Because I was not distressed at seeing the Seneca camp, predominantly white women, moving forward around a very significant issue. I think that, you know, and this has to do with, you know, the changing me also, because at one time I thought, well, we always had to do it together. If there was a black one person there, there had to be a white person there, you know, that's the way we had to deal with it. As opposed to saying that the leadership's primary responsibility is to be conscious, having done some study and some research of world events and world history, so that once you bring your people together, whatever the primary group is, you know, whether it's based on black, white, gender, what, that you can begin to expose those people and learn from those people ways of making change, okay? So if you go to Seneca and all you discuss is the nuclear bomb as opposed to the kinds of things that I heard, you know, Jeb talking about, then that would have disheartened me more than not seeing a whole bunch of black folks there. Because I tend to believe that our experience coming out of the 60s was that perhaps our strength is in being connected at one level, but then operating very differently at another level. When I say connected at one level, operating differently at another level, what do I mean? That the right to self-determination, to me, for black folk, means that we have got to get together and decide how we will move forward. Not in you know, a fashion that says other people sit down with us and decide how we'll move forward. We have to decide that. Okay. On the other hand, I think that there shouldn't be a separation that doesn't allow me to dialogue with other groups, you know, whether they're Native American, whether they're Chicano, whether they're Latin, whether they're white, etc., to dialogue and say, okay, where are the connections? How is my movement forward assisting you and your movement forward? And also coming together on some issues, like I felt real good when the response to Grenada brought 10,000 people to the UN of all people. Okay, so, you know, there are times when all people do need to get together, but I don't feel distressed when I see, you know, a camp like that. You know, I know that I felt a few years ago there was a white organizer, male organizer, that I'd had a chance to sit down and talk with, who had spent some time in North Carolina and dealt with the racism in North Carolina, and said, you know, it was real easy for me to go into the black community and work with the black community against this thing, racism. The problem became difficult when I, as a white person, had to go into the white community and get them to understand what the problem is. And I think that, you know, once you're able to reach that level of understanding, that my responsibility as a white person would be to go into my community and make sure that the consciousness I have becomes a consciousness that is shared with those other groups in that community.
Well, I, of course, agree with Sala, but I would like to kind of address it as a white person. I think that what we have to understand as white people is how much we gain when we make what we're doing not only accessible to all kinds of people, but we make it attractive to women of color and people of color to want to deal with us, you know, more closely in terms of a coalition or working together, and that when we think of doing these things as extra work, you know, or as somehow additional to or alongside of what is the main thing, that we're missing it. You know, because of how much we have to gain, you know, by the broader participation in not in our movement, you know, but in some kind of way of moving all together. I don't even know if I'm being clear about it, but I mean, so much of white women's movement stuff has been, you know, to try to get a black woman by the hand to walk along with us, you know, so that we're somehow validated, rather than making, you know, the movement that we're in be you know, be really a unified movement in a sense. Now, what I want to say is that I think that when you put something in upstate New York, that, you know, in rural upstate New York, that there's only so much that you can do to make it accessible to all kinds of people, and that, you know, we can't, you know, go beyond, you know, what's reasonable. So rather than dump on ourselves about that, you know, we have to do what we can do there. And I think it was clear that what we can do, again, as white people, is work on these issues among ourselves, you know, to a certain extent, to make accessibility, you know, more important than it has been, and then to make sure that we do other things as well. You know, our movement is not limited to Seneca. And the things that I have seen women who have come from there go on to do, you know, in other areas where it's possible to work in different kinds of coalition, where it's possible to go into other, you know, areas, has been very encouraging to me.
I know Andrew's going to retort that there are hundreds of people in upstate New York and hundreds of black men in there and women in there also. Mm-hmm.
I think I made myself unclear, which is my first time. Which is, I completely agree with what both of you said. I don't think the issue is to try and get lots of, you know, women up to be in the encampment together, because that's not going to happen tomorrow. But the issue is, what issues are we going to address, and whose leadership are we going to follow? And that, I believe, the only way to really, you're right, in order to get out and organize in our own communities about racism, that's our responsibility. But I think that we can only do that by learning from women of color what are the issues and how to do it. And so all, I'm using Seneca as an example of that. We keep talking about these things, but that we're not talking to each other earlier on in organizing processes. And I'm trying to make an indictment, I guess, without being a, you know, jerk. That, it's a long, hard process, and that it just, I don't see it happening that different women in different struggles talking to each other early on to really learn from each other. That's all I mean to say. Plus, I totally disagree with you about upstate New York. What are you saying? There's tons of millions of people up there, you know? I mean, there's big cities. It's like, it's not like New York. You know? Is this a big company? No, I'm using this.
Did you have a question?
No, I had some comments. And I don't think I want to be very clear, but I want to try. So comments to you. And I think what you're saying applies probably to everyone here, so I'm going to try to focus it in a way that applies to all the white women who have the same kind of question that you have. One of the things that the panelists have said, they have named many of the issues that are black women's issues, that are red women's issues, that are brown women, young women's issues. And every place I go, I hear black women doing that. So that there are many books written, there are many programs, so the issues have been laid out so that you can go through that material to find out what the issues are and what we are struggling with every day. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing is that when you plan the activities at Seneca, you have racism workshops, which I think is appropriate, but you include racism in every other thing that you do. You don't just have separate racism workshops. Racism becomes a part of what you do. Everything you do, you examine everything you do in terms of how is this combating racism. If it doesn't try to get rid of racism, it's not relevant. So you do that with everything. You don't only do that, but everybody talks about the links between the different kinds of oppression. So it's not just racism, but you need to look at all the other oppressions in the same way. And in every step of all the work you do, you have to say, how does this combat sexism? How does this combat war? How does this combat imperialism? How does this combat just all of them. That's what you have to do with all the work you do. It is a lot of work, and it can feel overwhelming, but we can do it. What else? There was something else that you said that I wanted to. Are there paid jobs involved in Seneca?
Yeah.
How many paid jobs are there?
There's going to be 10.
Is it going to be enough woman money that a black woman can support a family on? Okay, so you have to look at some real things. You know, if you want to involve black women, you have to pay us enough money to have to do it.
I'm speaking specifically
about some specific things about how much it costs for us to live in this country in spite of the fact that we make less money, okay? The other thing is that There was something in the slideshow, I think, about weekend work, Harry, something, I don't remember what. But you can do lots of weekend kinds of things, but it doesn't have to be bringing black women up there. It can be finding out what black women are doing in other parts of the country and go join us. Send money to us for what we're doing. I could go on and on, but you get the idea of what I mean?
I have to announce that it's 1 o'clock and lunch has been going. I think I should let people leave, but I would like to announce that in this same room, in the afternoon, unfortunately the same time as the plenary, but it will be possible for anybody who's interested in returning to discuss this question further to come back to this room just as it is and to discuss.